From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The USA Patriot Act turned 4 years old last month, and Congress and legal experts are still debating whether it has helped combat terrorist groups, where it has, that is, and where it has walked unnecessarily on the rights of Americans. Now comes word of a secret power given to the FBI under the Patriot Act that has allowed agents to pry into the lives of tens of thousands in this country. The power shows up in a letter. It's called a national security letter. It's easy for an FBI agent to get. The boss signs it. The Justice Department asks no questions. Armed with one of these writs, the agent can demand that any librarian, any phone company or internet provider, any credit card company, anyone, hand over records of who you are calling, what you are buying, when you traveled to Vegas, and whether you ordered pay-per-view. The librarian or internet provider can't say no, and is forbidden from ever telling anyone what happened. And you can't complain because you never knew it happened. The FBI says this is good old-fashioned gumshoe police work for the information age, and that it is necessary to head off attacks that no one wants. Critics say it is domestic surveillance run amok, the blurring line between security and a security state. This hour On Point, asking how wide a net the FBI should be allowed to have over security, over Americans' personal lives. You can join the conversation. Where do you draw this line? How much secret domestic surveillance is too much? And are we there yet? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We will be hearing later in this hour from Valerie Caproni, general counsel for the FBI, from Congressman Peter DeFazio, who's been a sharp critic of the national security letter's use, and from Colleen Rowley, the FBI whistleblower, retired special agent in Minnesota. Right now joining me from Palo Alto, California, is Barton Gilman. He's national reporter for The Washington Post, and he broke the story of the exploding use of national security letters in last Sunday's paper. Bart Gilman, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Tom.
So tell us what's going on here. What is a national security letter, and what's this explosion of use that you're describing?
A national security letter is an instrument that was invented more or less in the 1970s after the U.S. government started passing assorted privacy laws. The letters began as exceptions to consumer privacy law so that the FBI could get things like your credit records or your telephone calls if it could show reason to believe that you were a spy or a terrorist. What the Patriot Act did was it removed that requirement. The FBI now has to show, or to assert actually, only that your records would be relevant to their investigation to protect against terrorism.
So it's been around for a long time, but what's changed here? They don't have to, there's not the same standard of what they have to show. Who do they have to convince that they need to produce one of these letters or that they should be able to deliver one of these letters?
Well, this was always an instrument used entirely within the FBI. It would be an FBI senior supervisor, could be the head of a field office or someone at headquarters. They've dispersed the power so that there are now about five dozen people in the FBI who can authorize them. There's no judge and no prosecutor involved.
Give us a practical example, Bart Gilman, of a situation in which the FBI might want to use these. You say that there are 30,000 of these letters every year being, cranked out now. In what kind of circumstance are they used?
Well, yeah, just to start with the numbers, there are about 30,000 a year now. That's two orders of magnitude higher. Let's just take a quick analogy.
That is 100 times what it used to be.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Something on the order of 100 times what it used to be. Look, a physical search is an old power, but it makes a difference whether you can only search someone when you have probable cause to believe that you'll find something, or whether when a bicycle goes missing you can search every room in an apartment house to see where it might be. It's a little bit closer to the latter that's happening now with NSLs, the national security letters. So the FBI will have a suspect. They will get the suspect's telephone records. Again, this is a terrorist suspect.
Right.
Then they'll say, okay, who's that person calling? That person's calling 100 people. Well, let's find out who those 100 people are calling. So now, by definition, you've gone through and sought the records for 100 people that you have no particular reason to suspect of wrongdoing.
And are we just looking at their phone records, or are we digging on into their credit records, their Visa, their purchasing in library books and the whole works?
We don't know very much about the standard practices of investigators because they don't want to talk about them. I doubt, personally, that anyone who ever made one phone call to a suspect is having their complete financial life worked over, but whenever the FBI considers it to be relevant to an investigation, they can do that. If they had reason to think that, if their own belief was that it would be relevant to get the bank records and the credit records and the pawn shop records and the casino records of everybody that was on that call list, they could do that.
You blew this open on Sunday. You opened your report, Bart Gellman, with the story of a man, George Christian, who worked in a library system in Connecticut. He got this letter, and it said, what did they want, and what did they tell him he could and could not reveal publicly about the request?
Well, he got two FBI agents came to his place of work. They handed him a letter. The letter said, please give us all subscriber information, billing information, and access logs of any person who used a particular computer at one of the libraries in his system. He's a digital service provider,
right,
for Connecticut libraries. And the other thing it said, which is standard for national security letters, is that he was forbidden to tell, quote-unquote, any person that he had received this letter. So it's you have to hand over the information, and you may not disclose that you've been asked.
And the people who would be surveilled would never know that they'd been the targets of surveillance. This week, there's already been scrutiny of the Patriot Act to crank it up or to crank it down in advance of this December 31st deadline. This week, after your report, this very portion, the national security letter business, has got attention from Congress. I see a number of moves afoot here to get more oversight of how these are exercised. Do those appear to be gaining traction, Martin Gellman?
Well, I see that there's been a sense of the House passed to give some sort of judicial oversight. There's been some public statements by various members of the House and Senate. It's unusual to have any substantial change written during a conference on a big, complicated piece of legislation, and both House and Senate already had passed versions of a Patriot Act extension, so it remains to be seen whether there'll be major changes made or not.
And who's pushing back against this? I mean, everybody knows it's a big job to fight terrorism. Nobody wants another 9/11. We've seen in Amman, Jordan, just in the last 24 hours, what can happen. So where's the pushback coming from, the right or the left?
Well, gosh, it's not that easy to do right-left on this one. But in general, if you have more trust in authority and more belief that authority ought to have, you know, the widest possible range of tools to fight terror, then you'll want the least restrictions on national security letters. And I should say that I think the FBI, in good faith, cares about finding terrorists and thinks this tool matters. And they have this sort of unbelievably huge job.
Yes, they
just
do.
To detect in advance sort of stealthy attacks on the United States and prevent them. And anything that they could imagine helping them in some circumstance, they're going to want to have.
And yet, we've got a Constitution, a Bill of Rights and Liberties that we're accustomed to having. I see here a very conservative voice, Paul Weyrich, chairman and CEO of the Free Congress Foundation, saying because of the war on terrorism, America may be on the verge of becoming a national security state. It's a tough balance. I want to bring another voice in here from California. Joining us from San Francisco is Jim Dempsey, executive director of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Jim Dempsey, thanks for being with us. What do you make of this apparent explosion in the use of national security letters?
Tom, hello, and Bart, hello. Great story, really phenomenal work. You know, Tom, I think you alluded to a couple things that I want to right away get sort of off the table as accepted. There's clearly a real threat of terrorism.
Right.
The FBI clearly needs access to information in order to prevent another terrorist attack. And there are good, hardworking people at the FBI. Valerie Caproni, who you're going to have on later, is one of the best. We really owe them a debt of gratitude. They're working tirelessly to protect us.
Yep.
But even good people need checks and balances. Even good people need a framework to operate in a set of guidelines and rules. And what's happened with these national security letters over the past number of years is a series of changes that in their cumulative effect are pretty dramatic, as Bart Gellman's story demonstrated. First of all, the Patriot Act took away the requirement, which had been on the books before. These things have been around for a while.
Right.
But they used to say that the FBI used to have some reason to believe that the person whose records they were getting was a terrorist or was connected with a terrorist or was financing terrorism or was somehow involved. It didn't have to be probable cause. It
mm-hmm.
didn't have to be rock tight. But there had to be some minimal factual basis for going and asking for some of these records.
And post 9/11 with the Patriot Act with John Ashcroft, that gone.
That's gone. Secondly, now all they have to go in and say is, we have an investigation, we want these records, period. Of course, they only say it to themselves. There's no...
No judge, no congressional oversight.
No judge, no prosecutor, no... They don't even have to, so to speak, go across the street to the Justice Department and get approval there.
And Jim Dempsey, we're going to come and look at the details of that, but the concern here, a kind of routinization, routine intrusion into private lives, and we hear it at the same time, a great big job to be done. Jim Dempsey, Martin Gellman with the Washington Post, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking about large-scale new FBI surveillance that has gone unreported under the Patriot Act in the war on terror. What do you think? How wide a net should the FBI be allowed to throw? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about wide-scale new FBI surveillance that has gone unreported until this last weekend in the Washington Post under the Patriot Act as part of the war on terror. We've been joined by Barton Gellman, who broke the story on Sunday, joining us from Palo Alto. Jim Dempsey's with us from San Francisco. He's executive director of the Center for Democracy and Technology. You can join us as well. What do you think? This is a tough one. How wide a net should the FBI be allowed to throw secretly over Americans' personal lives in the fight against the very real terror threat? How much unreported domestic surveillance is too much? And can you imagine being ordered to hand over personal records of maybe hundreds of colleagues or clients and being ordered never to breathe a word of the order or what you'd done? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to be joined in a moment by Congressman Peter DeFazio in Washington. We're joined right now from Washington by Valerie Caproni. She is general counsel for the FBI. Valerie Caproni, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So we're all reading Bart Gellman's piece and seeing the flap that's ensued about it this week. Is the FBI, with the best of intentions, abusing a power of surveillance here under the Patriot Act post 9/11, Valerie?
No, we're not. And I think what I would like to do is correct a couple of things that I believe are misperceptions.
Yes,
about
please.
National security letters. For instance, you've referred to them as a writ. They're not a writ. They're a letter. And they request the recipient to provide us with certain information that's necessary for our investigations.
But it's pretty tough. It says, give it to us and tell no one about it. So,
that's
this isn't
true.
Patty cake.
That's true. But you also indicated that we could serve them on any librarian, anyone. And that's not true. National security letters actually have very limited scope. They're limited types of records that we can obtain under a national security letter. To the extent we could ever serve one on a library, it would be not for library, typical, traditional library lending records. You know, we're going to find out whether you read Fannie Hill or not.
Yep.
We can't do that. That's not a type of record that we can get. We could serve an NSL on a library if they are providing Internet connections, if they're acting as an electronic communication service provider.
But it's not exactly it's not just a laser beam. I mean, it's Internet records, bank records, phone records, financial records. This is not so terribly narrow.
Well, those are all different types, and they're all used in very different ways and in differing volumes. By far, the thing that we need NSLs most for in connection with terrorism investigations are something that I think most people wouldn't be all that concerned about. We can use them to find out who belongs to a particular telephone number, who is the subscriber to that number. And that's information that's publicly available for plain old telephone lines. You have crisscross directories that you go by the telephone number and you find out the subscriber. In a world of cell phones, the crisscross directories don't work so well. But if we get, you know, if we pick up a terrorist and they have an American telephone number in their pocket, we need to know whose telephone number that is.
Let's talk about subscriber information. What about the number? I've got to lose Bart Gellman in just a minute here, I know. But he reports that 30,000 plus a year of these letters have been issued since 9/11. That's 100 times more than before. Has he got the scale right?
I can't comment on the numbers. The numbers are classified. I don't know where he got that number from. I won't confirm or deny it. But on the other hand, 30,000, if you're talking about over a five-year period.
No, it's 30,000 per year, 100 times more than before is what's reported.
Again, I can't confirm or deny that. Mm-hmm. But again, subscriber information is pretty innocuous information that we get via NSLs, and that is one of the types of NSLs that we count when we provide these statistics to our oversight committees. So 30,000, you know, in the abstract, is 30,000 a large number? Well, it depends on what we're getting with that. I suspect that if anyone counted up the number of grand jury subpoenas that are issued for subscriber information of telephone numbers, that it would dwarf that number.
And why not judicial oversight? Why not have somebody paying attention to what's being asked from whom?
Well, first off, a lot of people are paying attention to what is being asked for whom. We've got an awful lot of oversight that occurs from Congress. These particular letters, in fact, can only be issued if they are approved at the highest level of the individual office that they're coming from. That's inevitably an agent that has significant experience, not a brand new AUSA. If you're talking about a grand jury subpoena, they can be authorized by an AUSA who's been in that U.S. attorney's office for 2 days.
You mean a young attorney general? I mean, a young attorney there.
A very young attorney who has no real judgment, and not to, you know, not to denigrate AUSAs. I used to be an AUSA.
Sure.
And I love them all dearly. Mm. But the reality is these can only be approved by seasoned agents who look at what is the rationale for this individual national security letter. So it's not, there's no rubber stamp on these national security letters.
Ms. Caproni, if you can stand by for just a second, I just want to get Barton Gellman's reply here before we let him go. Bart Gellman, two things here, characterizations. Number one, there is a lot of oversight of national security letters, a lot. And they're not just issued willy-nilly. This is by experienced FBI agents, so don't worry about it. What do you say to both of these?
Well, I have no doubt that inside FBI channels, there is oversight of national security letter requests. The standard of approval, however, is pretty low. If relevance is a pretty easy standard to meet, the model sentence in their internal guidelines for how do you request this information says, in effect, I'd like to get these toll records so I can find out who the subject is calling.
Yep.
Which is almost sort of a self-executing
standard.
As far as Congress is concerned, the only information they get is the overall number of national security letters. They don't get any information about what's being requested or from whom or with what investigative results.
And so that's not exactly tight scrutiny. Bart Gellman with The Washington Post, thank you for your reporting, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Jim Dempsey, we'll go back to Valerie Caproni in just a moment, general counsel at the FBI, but you've heard her characterization as well. She's saying, look, we're trying to do our job. This isn't so extraordinary. These are seasoned agents. There's a lot of oversight here. The sort of message there is, why is the country, why is the media in such a tizzy about this?
Well, because I think, you know, we've seen a convergence of several factors here. The Patriot Act lowered the standard. It used to say you had to be focused on a possible terrorist. You no longer have to be focused on a possible terrorist. Secondly, after the Patriot Act, the definition of financial institutions, some of these go to so-called financial institutions. Well, Congress went in a somewhat of a sneaky move and expanded the definition of financial institution to include car dealers and travel agents, and a host of other entities, pawn shops, and the U.S. Postal Service is now considered to be a financial institution under this authority. Thirdly, and I think most importantly, we're still in the midst, obviously, of the digital revolution. The amount of data that exists on people out there and the ability to hold it and analyze it and share it has grown exponentially. And there's just a lot more data out there. A third thing that happened, which Bart Gellman reported in his story, was that the Attorney General guidelines were rewritten after the Patriot Act to say that the FBI, if it did one of these orders and found nothing relevant, found that the person they were interested in was not a terrorist, had no connections, was doing nothing wrong, was innocent, they could still keep that information.
And keep it forever, if I read correctly.
They could give it to other agencies who could dump it into their computers, shake it and bake it, and try to come up with suspicious connections. And that's, of course, this whole controversy over data mining. So it's in this context, no individualized focus or reasonable suspicion or anything on the targeting of these, broadened definition of the entities to which they apply. A library is considered a telephone company in for these purposes. And this whole digital revolution that produces all these records that sit out there in the hands of businesses who really have little interest in telling us what they're doing with those records.
And can be mined and mined. Valerie Caproni.
That says to me we need some checks and balances.
Yeah.
And congressional oversight right now is worthless. They get these raw numbers. They have not probed behind those. I'll bet that not a single member of Congress has ever seen a national security letter, and I'll bet that they've never seen what is produced as a result of a national security
letter. Let me turn, Valerie Caproni, your general counsel at the FBI.
Right.
Congress is now talking about picking up a greater degree of oversight here. Would you oppose that?
You know, I would have to see what they're actually proposing. What we welcome oversight. We get a lot of oversight. We're overseen by both the intelligence committees and the judiciary committees. In my experience, they take a very active interest in what the FBI is doing. But, you know, we'd have to see what they're proposing. What we don't want to be in a position is that we're, you know, we're responding to congressional inquiries rather than conducting investigations.
Yep.
But I'd like to get back to something that was said, and this has been said several times, and I want to correct it.
Please.
It is true that the Patriot Act changed the standard, but let me explain what the problem with the prior standard was. The prior standard required not just some evidence that we were looking at a terrorist or that the records related to a terrorist or a spy. We had to have specific and articulable facts indicating that the person is a terrorist or a spy, meaning we had to already know what we were trying to investigate, which is this person a bad guy or not? And that was a very limiting factor on how we could use the NSLs. By changing the standard to relevance, is it relevant to an investigation? That brings it in line and in parity with the standard that exists for issuance of a grand jury. And remember, the records that we are getting on these are records that are not constitutionally protected. These are records that are being held by third parties. There are things like, who did you call? Who subscribes to this telephone number? What is your, you know, when you get into the more intrusive things, we understand that financial records are more intrusive. And one of the things that Congress gets to see, because these are classified numbers, is what are the ratios? Or does it look right? Are we, I mean, you would think as a logical matter that the less intrusive NSLs would be the ones that were used the most. Things like records for subscriber information.
Right.
And then maybe a little more intrusive is who did you call on your telephone? Who subscribes to this email address? That's a little more intrusive.
But it kind of makes us all feel a little more naked before the government than we're accustomed to, than we feel that we should be required to be. Is that just part and parcel of the war on terror era, Ms. Caproni?
I would say that it is to some extent that the way that the because we operate in secret, because this is classified, because we're operating against people who are terrorists and spies, I think Americans get concerned about things that they don't know. When they don't know what's happening, that gets them concerned. And we understand that. And what I can say is we've got, again, very active intelligence committees on the Hill who look very hard at what we do. We have a very active Inspector General in the Department of Justice who looks over our shoulder a lot at what we're doing.
And yet there's a call to do even more there. If I may, I'd like to turn to Capitol Hill for a moment and Congressman Peter DeFazio, Democratic congressman from Oregon's 4th District. He's a member of the House Homeland Security Committee. Peter DeFazio, Congressman, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
So here we are. We're looking at what's described as an explosion of national security letters. Give us this, tell us this, tell us this, and don't tell anyone we asked. Valerie Caproni, general counsel at the FBI, says, look, we're just trying to do our job, and we're doing it in a reasonable way with reasonable oversight. Do you agree?
No, the level of oversight is somewhere between pathetic and non-existent by the House of Representatives and the Senate in these matters. In fact, the administration was stonewalling even the Republican chairman of the Judiciary Committee for quite some time when he was requesting information on how the Patriot Act and provisions of it had been used. And they told him, even though he voted for it, supported it, he couldn't have that information. And it took quite some time and a lot of pressure for him to extract it. So, no, there's very, very little oversight. What causes me more concern is I think they're trying to patchwork together here John Poindexter's vision of a total information awareness network.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what the problem is? The NSA is evaluates about 5% of the photos we take around the world.
Yep.
And the FBI is going to gather massive amounts of data on all Americans, stick it into a data bank that's going to be accessible to other government agencies, other levels of government, and private entities, and I don't think they're going to get much useful out of it.
So you're saying it's an efficacy issue or a civil liberties issue? Which?
Well, it's both. I think it's this. We go out. We'll just go out and get everything, and we'll somehow data mine it, and we'll track down terrorists because of suspicious credit card activity. You know, it's like when you get the call from the credit card company. Well, is this you or is someone else using your card? I mean,
right.
I don't believe they should be more targeted in their approach. They should be more supervised. There's no problem with them going to judicial authorities to get permission for these sorts of activities. I really don't understand. I'm not aware that under the FISA Act that they were ever denied by a judge when they wanted to go forward and investigate and obtain, reams of data about individuals or suspected networks and those sorts of things.
So if that's the case, Valerie Caproni, why not go to a judge? Why not have a judge in the loop here so that, as you said, Americans are worried when they don't know what's going on? Maybe they'd be comforted to know there's some third party more actively involved in watching the flow of these letters.
Well, I'll tell you, it's interesting that there's this call that everything should go before the court, and the court should determine, again, whether we can get very basic investigative information. When the government gets this very basic investigative information without judicial oversight in a number of different arenas, through grand jury subpoenas, we get it in kiddie porn cases via administrative subpoenas, we get it in narcotics cases via administrative subpoenas. I think with all due respect, the congressman is raising the specter that we're collecting data on millions of Americans, I think he said, and we give the statistics to our oversight committees that tell them exactly how many Americans, how many different people we have collected information on. And I have no doubt that if we were showing that we were collecting data on millions of Americans, millions of different individuals that we had collected data on, that the oversight committees would have our heads.
But there's still the concern that it's too much outside bounds guaranteed by the Constitution. And Peter DeFazio raises the question of whether or not it's effective. What do you say to that, the effectiveness? Have you... Bart Gellman reports that this hasn't really been effective, that it hasn't really come up with results.
Well, in any given investigation, notwithstanding law and order, there's not typically a smoking gun where you can say, aha. But if you look at the cases where we've brought down terrorism plots, the Lackawanna case, the Portland case, NSLs were used in those investigations. So it is not the case. Well, I may not be able to say, okay, this was the smoking gun that showed that was a jihadist group. But the fact is, that would be like asking the person who prosecuted John Gotti, which grand jury subpoena gave you what you needed to put him in jail.
Peter DeFazio,
that's not how investigations work.
We've just got half a minute here. Do you think American civil liberties are being eroded here? Are we giving up what we have to give up to fight terrorism or not?
Well, she's very, very adroit verbally, but the oversight by Congress, I can tell you, on Homeland Security, I'm privy to all the same data as Judiciary and intelligence, or for the most part, as far as I know, and it is non-existent.
Just not there.
Just like as much scrutiny goes into that data and overseeing the operations of these agencies in these matters as went into passing the original Patriot Act, which was not read
which
by
was real quick and we
Congress
know it. I know
it
we've got to let you go. Congressman DeFazio, thank you for being with us. Valerie Caproni at the FBI, thank you. Colleen Rowley coming up. Jim Dempsey, stand by. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about massive new FBI surveillance that has gone unreported until just the last few days under the Patriot Act in the War on Terror, the so-called use of national security letters. You can join our conversation. What do you think? You've been listening. Is this what it takes to fight terrorism, or is this going too far? Should somebody, the courts, Congress, someone, have more oversight of this? Are we quietly, secretly becoming a surveillance state? Is this what it takes to get the job done? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jim Dempsey from the Center for Democracy and Technology is with us. We'll hear in a moment from Colleen Rowley, the whistleblowing FBI agent from Minnesota. Right now, Sonia's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Sonia. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hello. I'd like to say that this is not what it takes to get the job done. There's no reason not to have judicial oversight on investigating Americans. We fight the Cold War and win it only to start becoming more like the Soviet Union ourselves. We go to war against Saddam Hussein while saying how terrible he is torturing people. And then we go into Iraq and start torturing people ourselves. And I'd like to say that I read Colleen Rowley's memo when it was made public.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that I've heard and everything that I've read about September the 11th leads me to one conclusion. The Bill of Rights did not cause September the 11th. Incompetence did. Freedom from government intrusion into our privacy did not cause September the 11th. Incompetence did.
Sonia, we've got the view, and let us take it straight to Colleen Rowley. She joins us from Apple Valley, Minnesota, retired special agent, former Minneapolis division counsel for the FBI, retired in 2004. She's currently running for Congress. We all know about her exposing lapses in the investigation of al-Qaeda operative Zakari Moussaoui. Colleen Rowley, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So we're reaching out to you as somebody we want to trust here as a kind of an impartial and good judge of what's going on. You surely have read the reports, 30,000 plus of these letters going out a year. Nobody can even say, can even tell when they get one. Is this reasonable in the war on terror, or is this going too far, Colleen Rowley?
Well, if Mr. Gelman had read the paper that I wrote almost 2 years ago, he could have broke the story a while ago, because I actually started to see some of the same bad direction already, maybe even just months after 9/11 and the Patriot Act. The people who have spoken today have all made very valid points. But then they've also sugarcoated and glossed over some of the hard issues. So where we are right now, which is really good that even though it's 4 years later, mm-hmm. Mr. Gelman has done a tremendous job of exposing some of the real issues here. And it's what I've been trying to do also, because if you look at the effort on the part of police and law enforcement to
yep.
prevent all future acts of terrorism,
mm-hmm.
it is an impossible task. And you're putting people in this terrible position of saying, if I don't do this, it may be the one dot. We may miss the one dot. And even judges would be in the same position. And yet, the officials are not explaining the costs of this kind of very wide net and prevention at all costs mindset. They're not explaining this well to the public.
So we understand that tension. I mean, you miss that dot, as you say, and the wrath of the country comes down on you if there's a big attack. On the other hand, we value civil liberties in this country, so don't sugarcoat it for us. What's going on?
You know, officials, and of course Ashcroft was probably the epitome of this, have this idea that what the public doesn't know won't hurt them. And, of course, when you're dealing in a world of secrecy, certainly espionage and country-sponsored actions have to have that kind of secrecy. But terrorism is a slightly different animal. And what they probably are deluding themselves about a little bit, because it would be a nuisance, is that some of the, at least in a generic way, more information could be provided to other officials in order to have oversight over this process so that it doesn't go too far.
Do you have the sense it's being used kind of willy-nilly, turning into routine intrusion into private lives in this country?
Well, again, you go back to this problem of the fear factor, and every time an orange alert existed, and of course, the government is being disingenuous in this case, because when an orange alert came on, everybody was calling the FBI to report on their neighbors and their coworkers.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the FBI will say, well, we didn't initiate this. This was the public that called us. But see, at the same time, the orange alerts are provoking that kind of response on the part of the public. And then you get into this massive amount of data that goes into government databases, and you have that's a separate practical problem.
But is that necessary? Is that what is required to find the needle in a haystack to prevent another big terror attack?
Tom, this is Jim Dempsey.
Yes, Jim, please.
Jump in for a second. Hi, Colleen.
Hi.
You know, I think it's wrong, Tom, to mm-hmm. pose this as an either-or question.
Okay.
I think the caller was correct that checks and balances, oversight, controls, rules, these are not the things that are going to get in the way of an effective counterterrorism effort. These are the ways that we actually design one. I think the whole debate here is not do we have to choose or is this necessary. We can be safer, we can be more secure, and still have our privacy, still have our civil liberties. And I think the congressman was 100% right. Effectiveness and privacy go hand in hand here. Because if you have fishing expeditions,
mm-hmm.
if you have people out there sweeping up large amounts of data that they can't even analyze, that doesn't make us any safer.
So, Colleen Raleigh, why would the FBI resist closer oversight here? If we can have it both ways, have reasonable oversight as the law enforcement goes after terror threats.
Well, and along with that greater oversight, another possible solution, just limiting the secrecy. With terrorism, it's not the same as espionage. You could have a limited temporary secrecy apply.
But why is the FBI pushing back against that kind of limits and oversight?
I think it's just due to short-sightedness. And again, I go back to Ashcroft, who refused to even answer the question for a year about whether the FBI was going to libraries. If you have that kind of a low regard for informing the public, you think you're not looking at the pendulum and how it might swing maybe 3 years, 4 years down the road.
I want to turn to our callers, if I may. Ken is calling from Buford, South Carolina. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What do you think?
First of all, you know, we're making a mountain out of a molehill here in a lot of ways. These are separate issues, and tying them all together like this.
30,000 national security letters a year, we're told. Give it over to us and don't tell anyone we asked. That's a molehill?
Everything, the way everybody tries to tie it to other issues, dilutes the whole point of what they're trying to do. You've got 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10,
mm-hmm.
the more I listen, the more different things are going on. They're small things all related together. This issue, the one we're talking about of the letters and the investigation with Valerie Capone, I'd like to say hello to her and tell her I think she's doing a great job. I mean, she's not responsible for any perception of incompetence that her president might have.
So you say give the FBI this authority, don't lay on more oversight, and off they go. It's fine by you.
No, you put that words in my mouth. No, I think there should, and to continue, I think there should be oversight. Committee. Every time you do something, somebody's not going to do the right thing. I mean, if you work as a cashier, somebody's going to steal money. You can. Every job's going to have somebody not doing the right thing.
We got it. So have oversight, but let's not get so worked up about it. It sounds like you're saying it's work that needs to be done here. Ken, our time is short, but thanks for your call. Let me get another call. George is calling from McLean, Virginia. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, on one one hand, I am against the, you know, expansion of the national security letters, and my concern isn't generated by, well, I'm afraid of what I don't see.
Meaning?
You know, I stopped being afraid of the dark a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm concerned about is the acquisition of authority, power, if you will, established a history in the past. I mean, how many times must things take place before we pay attention to preventing abuse of power in the future?
You're looking back to the Cold War when we did see abuses of...
Specific example. Now, I realize it's a different agency, but the CIA started conducting a program, I think the FBI was involved, called COINTELPRO under Kobe's leadership, and even he became nervous about it because over time it expanded into the examination of people having different political views. In other words, if you're a Democrat, then perhaps you'd be investigated.
Right, so watch out. You may be the one on the receiving end. George, thanks for your call. Colleen Raleigh, how do you think the FBI is doing these days? Are you still close to it? They're using this this greater power in greater secrecy. Is it giving us effective counterterrorism work?
Well, I retired at the end of 2004, mm-hmm. So I don't know what's been going on since. But there is we've talked about the legalities of this, but there's also the practicalities. And the practical situation is that officials made the excuse that intelligence was like a fire hose, and you can't get a drink from it. There's so much water coming out. There's so much intelligence. And they said this before 9/11.
Right.
If it was a fire hose before 9/11, it's Niagara Falls right now. And of course, now you're pointing to the practical difficulty of actually finding that needle in a haystack, that dot that matters when you've made the amount of extraneous information in the system.
So if you collect too much, it's not focused enough, you're not doing yourself a favor, you're saying.
Yeah, it only can be counteracted, again, if we have Niagara Falls mm-hmm. out there in terms of data. The only thing that can counteract that is some kind of great computer data mining system, because then you would be able, in theory, to pull this out. But it does bring up the specter of all kinds of Orwellian-type, with the lack of privacy now, and connecting dots that shouldn't have been connected.
Mm-hmm. Jim Dempsey, we've just got half a minute here. You see the increased interest in Congress since this report came out. Do you think this is going to be corralled? Is it going to be reined in a bit?
Well, I mean, that's right now hanging in the balance. The members of the Conference Committee on the Patriot Act are actually meeting this week.
Yes.
And I think one great idea, actually, I think, is to put a sunset on these national security letters until we can have the kind of inquiry into how they work and what can we come up with a better standard. You know, Valerie Caproni said the old standard was too restrictive.
Mm-hmm.
I think the new standard is no standard at all. Well, let's spend the time to come up with a workable standard to address the kinds of Niagara Falls flood of information that Colleen's talking about.
I'll say amen to that. Get it out in the light of day. Sounds
right.
Like a good American way. Jim Dempsey, Executive Director of the Center for Democracy and Technology in San Francisco. Thanks very much for joining us, Mr. Dempsey.
My pleasure.
And Colleen Raleigh, retired special agent from the FBI, famed whistleblower, now a candidate for Congress. Ms. Raleigh, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, how Sony might be spying on you through the CD music you listen to. This is On Point. Imagine buying a Sony Music CD like the new Van Zandt album Get Right With The Man. You put the disc into your computer, click through an installation agreement, and play it. What you don't know is that Sony has secretly hidden anti-copying software on your computer that compromises the security of your hard drive. Sony says it's needed to stop piracy, but many experts are calling it a step too far. Joining me now from San Francisco is John Borland, who's been following the story for CNETnews.com. John, thanks very much for being with us. Hello, John, are you there?
I am.
John Borland, what exactly is Sony doing here and why?
Well, what they've done is they're trying to stop people from making unauthorized copies of their software. So they put, or of their CDs, mm-hmm. they put software on the CD that prevents you from doing that, that hides itself deep inside your computer. Unfortunately, that allows other people to install things on your computer which hide the same way. So today, you had the first Trojan horse appear in the wild that sort of takes advantage of this, hides itself on your computer, and sort of opens up your hard drive to manipulation by other people.
Now, how and why does it open it, your computer to manipulation by others?
It opens up what's called a back door, mm-hmm. just allowing other people to kind of get in if they use this technique. It's not Sony's technique that opens it up, but it's Sony's technique that hides it so that nobody can see what's going on. So what this is doing is creating kind of a black hole that other people can install things in. It's a very serious security concern.
So there's a security concern, but there's also this kind of spying issue. Security aside, once this is installed, is Sony watching what you do with your music, when and if you do it?
Sony is watching what CDs you play when you put them in the computer, so it knows kind of what music you're listening to and when.
Is that legal?
I'm sorry?
Is that legal?
It depends on what the agreement that you've agreed to already has said. In this case, it's laid out that part. So, yes, it's probably legal. It's not attached to your name. It doesn't know who you are. It has an internet address, so it's not specific information, but it can gather all of this information.
And is that kind of just the way things work these days, John? When are we constantly being monitored unawares when we buy software, when we buy CDs, or is Sony breaking new ground here?
It's not breaking new ground. Virtually any media player on your computer will tell somebody somewhere what you're listening to. It's new ground that it's hiding this inside of your computer so deeply. It's new ground for the record companies themselves to be watching so specifically what you're doing as well.
Sony's just installed this so far on about 20 titles, the Van Zandt album Get Right With A Man and others. What's Sony saying? Are they going to keep doing this, or the blowback is too much for them?
Sony is backing away from this specific technique. The fact that it's such a security risk, which could open you up to other kinds of identity theft and that kind of thing, that's a big black eye for them. Whether or not they're backing away from copy protection as a whole and the kind of monitoring of what you're doing is another question. They haven't talked about that yet.
And do we know whether Sony BMG is the only company doing this, or might there be others already doing it?
There's other companies that are using different techniques that don't have this problem. So as far as we know, Sony BMG is the only big company that's doing it. There's a few other smaller record labels that have also used this technique. But
does it actively keep you from pirating the Sony CD? Does it keep you from burning another disc, let's say?
That's right. What it does is sort of inserts itself between you and your CD drive, and so it kind of makes sure that you're not making copies or making MP3s that can be sent online through peer-to-peer networks.
But maybe they'll back right down. Seems like everybody is watching something these days. John Borland with CNETNews.com, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Mary Moore, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Odette and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.